It is true that when you do a cost segregation, we're not creating tax deductions out of thin air. What we're doing is we're kind of going into the future, we're collecting those future tax deductions, and we're taking them up front.
Do you love your job, but want other investment options than your company's 401k and trying to pick stocks? If so, you've come to the right place. In this podcast, you will get actionable information for your passive real estate investment journey. Welcome back to another episode of Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast. Here's your host, Justin Dixon.
Bernard, man, welcome to the podcast. I'm happy to have you on.
Justin, great to be here. Been looking forward to this. I love talking about anything real estate investing, especially if there's a tax angle. So looking forward to diving in.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, very cool. Well, let's kick things off. Maybe give us a bit of an intro on you and kind of what you're up to.
Yeah, glad to do that. CPA. If there's anything tax related, I've probably touched it at some point, but transitioned to focusing on what I call the real estate tax trifecta. That's self-directed retirement accounts, real estate IRAs, 401ks, and qualified plans, cost segregation, and 1031 exchange. Up until recently, all of these really apply to almost many types of investments. 1031 exchanges were available for baseball teams and yachts and airplanes. Self-directed retirement accounts are still available for many, many asset classes, not limited to real estate. Cost segregation, similarly. However, consistently, real estate is the asset that is kind of always there, has proven itself, and is always the most popular application of all of these tax tools.
Got it. Yeah. I'm definitely interested in diving into all of these kind of areas. As a real estate investor myself, an entrepreneur, I've utilized some of these vehicles, if you will, in my journey as well. So I guess, how did you kind of get into the CPA world? And then at what point did you kind of realize that the real estate investing in kind of space was an area that you wanted to kind of carve out? Because I know based on your LinkedIn, you do a lot of work with like investors and all of that. So I'm kind of curious kind of how that journey kind of started and happened.
Yeah, it was not premeditated. It was not planned. In hindsight, you can connect the dots, but it's not as if you got started out saying, hey, this is where I want to go. Initially, when I began the CPA route, it wasn't necessarily because, hey, I felt like I want to be a CPA. That's what I want to do for life. It just seemed to be a reasonable thing to get into, to be kind of foundations for business.
Yeah.
That's really how it started. I did work at a management consulting firm while I was still in school. As soon as I graduated, I accepted a job offer from PwC. But some of the experience, and I had some pretty interesting, the kind of experience that you very seldom get when you're just starting or even step foot the door at PwC. And I quickly realized that's not what I wanted to do.
Got it.
So I told them that I'm not actually going to be coming in. And one of the first gigs that I did was working for a family office. And kind of that opened your eyes to what's out there. And one of the things I saw people doing there was it was really a single family office, but they kind of brought the friends and family in. Then you started seeing all these other asset classes, and you started seeing people were doing this in their IRAs and 401ks.
Yeah.
And that kind of opened the door. And as I say, the rest is history.
Yeah, it's interesting. Once you get kind of into the real estate world, you learn about all these different asset classes. Maybe you started in single family and you're like, oh, wait, I can do house hack or I can do multifamily. And then my last corporate recruiting gig before I started my own business was at a wealth management firm. It started as a single family office and then blew up over the 30-year or 50-year time it was around. But yeah, you see that what the rich people are doing with their money, and it's not necessarily the same that the average Joe is doing, right? So you kind of see all these strategies and all that stuff. So let's kind of unpack some of the different things that you've helped people work with that I'm assuming that most everybody can access, right? You don't have to be a multi-million billionaire to utilize a self-directed IRA or a solo 401k or a 1031 exchange. So maybe let's walk through kind of what these things are if somebody that's listening isn't as familiar, because when I started my journey, I wasn't aware of what a self-directed IRA was. But once I learned, that was the first two investments, passive investments that my wife and I did into multifamily. So at a very high level, let's kind of just dig into a self-directed IRA, what it is and how somebody can utilize it and what assets that they can invest in with it.
Yeah, let's do it. And I love self-directed retirement accounts because they truly are accessible to everyone. In fact, it is kind of same journey you've had as what so many people have. It really opens the doors because there are so many Americans that have their investable assets kind of locked up inside of retirement accounts. Mm-hmm. Now, when you go to invest in real estate, realistically, some amount of capital is needed. I know there are a lot of folks out there saying invest in real estate with no capital. There are really ways to do that, right? You can get seller financing, you can get a private loan to fund your equity. You can't do it, but there's got to be capital coming from somewhere. Right.
Got to be money somewhere. Yeah.
And the more of it that you actually control, the easier it is to get into deals. Can you get into, say, hey, wake up one day, read a book, invest in real estate, no money down, find somebody to give you a seller finance deal, 100% seller finance? It's possible.
Yeah.
But those really are not as common as some would lead you to believe.
The social media gurus make it out to be, right? Like, it's super simple. Just read this book or whatever. Yeah. No, I get it. I get it.
So 401k or an IRA is where so many Americans have their funds locked up. And tapping into those funds to begin a journey is transformative. So what is this? Retirement accounts, which we're accustomed to believing have to be invested in mutual funds, stocks, or bonds, do not have to be. And contrary to what many people may think, even once they're introduced to self-directed retirement accounts, they sometimes think there's like two different types of IRAs. There's a regular IRA and a self-directed IRA. As in, Section 408 of the tax code talks about IRAs, and Section 409 is going to be self-directed IRAs. Hmm. It's not the case. Section 408 is IRAs. It says nothing in there about investing in the stock market or in real estate. Because from the perspective of the tax code, it's all the same. So what we ended up with was industries being built up around the tax code. So financial advisors, broker dealers very quickly realized, hey, this new section of the tax code that was introduced, right? By now it's decades and decades ago. Hey, we can use this to get money under management. So let us offer free IRA accounts, and then we've got hostage money.
Yeah.
And this way, this money's locked up. It's our AUM to play with for decades. If they want to take it out, hey, it's no backseas because you get a penalty, right?
Yeah.
Pull it out, you get taxes, you get penalties, right? It's kind of an asset manager's, an asset gatherer's dream.
Yeah.
But that built up very quickly around the traditional asset space. So that's stocks and bonds where folks are making money for assets under management. So what got short shrift is, hey, do you know that you can use this for real estate? You can use this for just about any asset class. And it doesn't have to be on somebody's platform where they're making money on your money.
Yeah.
Schwab, asset managers, money managers, they are primarily sellers of assets. They're primarily holders of assets. That's what they want. They offer IRAs as a way to really feed their primary business, which is holding your money. There's another industry, and that's a self-directed IRA industry, where the actual IRA is the service offering. And then you can invest in whatever you choose. We have nothing to sell. We have no assets to sell you. We are totally agnostic. If the tax code allows it, you can't do it. So that industry is way smaller. It is dwarfed by the kind of the IRA that everybody knows. But that's what a self-directed IRA is about, giving you access to all the investments that the tax code allows.
And so I guess if you're a person listening to this and you've maybe worked for, call it 10, 15 years, you've had multiple jobs, so likely you have 401k money in an old custodial account or 401k account with an old employer that you may not have rolled into your current 401k. So how I used it was I took one of my old 401ks at a previous employer, rolled it into a self-directed IRA, and that gave me the ability to direct that investment or that money where I wanted. Because obviously it was being held by Fidelity. Fidelity wasn't going to let me move it into real estate. So I had to move it out of Fidelity and move it into a self-directed IRA custodian, if you will, or a checkbook IRA to then play with the funds, right? So if somebody has that scenario, like what are the options for them to, because like I said, you can't just go to Fidelity or Vanguard or whatever and say, hey, cool, I've got this 100 grand in this old 401k. I want to invest in this real estate asset, right? Like you have to actually move it someplace.
Yeah, absolutely. So there are a couple of questions that folks have to go through to determine the best route for them. We've got some helpful flowcharts for this. But firstly, as you say, it's got to stay in the retirement account system. So what we're doing is we're setting up a new retirement account to which the funds can be transferred tax-free. So at Schwab or Fidelity or Vanguard, wonderful firms, I think they're great at what they do. The only bone I've got to pick with some folks is that there's a mission. You know, when you go to talk to a financial advisor and you think they're telling you the absolutely, you think they're looking at the full universe of what you can do and are saying, you know what, I thought about investing in an S&P 500 ETF, total stock market, Russell 2000, foreign, international, and they also thought about investing in syndicated real estate. Mm-hmm. And they said, but you know what? I've taken your profile into account and I figured out that you shouldn't put anything into real estate. Right. And you should put everything into the stock market. That's where I have an issue to pick with the traditional industry. But Schwab, those are companies that are wonderful for stocks. But if you want to do real estate, you have to move it into an IRA or a 401k with a company that lets you invest in real estate. So the first thing is identifying a company that does that. Practically, there are about 60 companies that are involved in the space. Different structures out there. Personally, we default to providing checkbook control, which is kind of a niche within self-directed retirement accounts. And it's really something that passive investors and their investment sponsors love. So yeah. Let's talk about what this is all about. So as you mentioned, IRAs have to have a custodian that's hard-coded in the tax code. That's in there, section 408. It's got to be a financial institution involved. In contrast, qualified retirement plans, such as 401ks, do not need a financial institution involved. So the first question is folks need to determine is, what type of self-directed account am I going to have? Right? We've all heard of IRAs. We've all heard of 401ks. All right, now that we know I can invest in real estate with both IRAs and 401ks, which one should I use?
Yeah.
Right? That's the first question I got to ask. And we help folks with that as part of the onboarding process. After that, once they figure that out, something they have to know is, do they want checkbook control or not? So what is that checkbook control? In checkbook control, even though this is happening under the rubric of an IRA or a 401k, the investor actually gets the money in a bank account that they control, which makes investing really easy, really smooth, and effortless.
Yep.
Now, what is the value of that? So for folks that are new to this, I've never experienced working with a custodian, it can get to be very cumbersome. No shade on the custodians, but unlike the publicly traded space where everything can be automated, when you're going into private investments, there's really very little room for automation. We can have nice dashboards and nice client portals, but ultimately processing of every transaction is manual. Right. Yeah. Your syndicator is giving you a set of subscription documents that we've got to manually review and manually sign. And so when you work without checkbook control, the investor has to sign all the documents. The custodian's got to sign all the documents and a lot of custodian paperwork has to be done, which all costs time, money, and a migraine headache.
Yeah. Yeah.
So with checkbook control, you get to sidestep all that, and it kind of gets to be very much like investing without an IRA. You have money in a bank account, you wire it in. With checkbook control, you have that same ease of investing, and there's no custodian paperwork to do either. So that is, as you say, money's got to be rolled over, but once it's rolled over, you can get it in a bank account, and you can invest directly out of that bank account quickly, easily, and at a very low cost.
Yeah, I want to dig into the solo 401k for any entrepreneurs out there. But before we do that, we're going to take a quick sponsor break. So we'll be right back.
Whether you're in a job you love or hate, building a financial foundation is important. This foundation can support you by providing passive income, stability in an uncertain economy, or the launching pad for you to start your own business. Great Venture Capital helps busy professionals invest in commercial real estate to build passive income streams, grow wealth, and take advantage of tax benefits. If you'd like to learn more, check us out at greatventurecapital.com or send an email to justin@greatventurecapital.com.
All right, we are back on the Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast with Bernard. We've been talking about self-directed IRAs. And before we went to break, we were talking about kind of the differences between custodial accounts and kind of the checkbook accounts. My wife and I, we have one of each. And I think the custodial account for a new investor kind of adds a layer of security, because your custodian will vet the deal, because you can't be an active participant in a deal that you invest with your self-directed IRA, right? Like, so they're kind of vetting to make sure that you're not going to invest in something that will get your hand slapped or worse from the tax man.
Yeah, absolutely. There's one set of rules you got to be aware of, really, is the prohibited transaction rules. One of the reasons we have a slight bias, we have a very broad and diverse client base, but we all breathe easier when people are investing passively. Mm-hmm. Because more or less the likelihood and possibility of running afoul of the rules gets to be very slim, unless they're the GP on the deal and they're using their own IRA to invest in their own deal. Otherwise, an LP can more or less invest very comfortably without be very confident they're not going to break any of the rules.
Yeah. So let's transition over to the solo 401k. So is this solely for people that are entrepreneurs that kind of own their own businesses, or who can kind of set up a solo 401k and what are some advantages?
Yeah. You're touching on one of my pet peeves because this is one of the topics about which there's a lot of, let's call it, incomplete information out there.
Okay.
So let's break it down. What is a 401k versus an IRA? And let's take it down kind of to the bare bones, the essence of IRA versus 401k. While each of these have lots of tax code and regulations associated with them, the first sentence of the tax code talking about IRAs is that it's an account set up for the benefit of an individual. Mm. And that's why it's called an IRA, an individual retirement account. The first sentence and the code that talks about 401k plan says that it's a trust set up by an employer for the benefit of employees. So once we kind of strip away to the essence of 401k plan, which is a type of qualified plan, we've got to have an employer and employee relationship, or you've got to be self-employed.
Got it.
Now, what does that mean? Because we do have folks out there that are telling people anybody can have a qualified retirement plan. Anyone can have a 401k. You can be working full time. You can be a retiree sitting at home or at the beach all day. Anybody can have a qualified retirement plan. If it doesn't fall within the definition of an employer sponsored plan, then right, it's not a qualified retirement plan. So we're looking primarily at people that are entrepreneurs. Now, it does not have to be a full time thing. It can be a side hustle. You can certainly have a W-2 and have a side hustle and set up a 401k plan for your side hustle. But you want it to be something that you can show has meaningful activity. It's not just you set something up because you want to set up
an LLC just to do a 401k or something.
Exactly.
Yeah. Got it. And so would you recommend that anybody that is an entrepreneur, whether it's a side hustle or they have a full-blown business where they have, maybe it is themselves or they have an employee or two, would you highly recommend people setting up the solo 401k or a 401k plan as the owner of a business?
So 401k has several advantages, but it does not come without additional compliance considerations. So solo 401k is actually, let's call it the sweet spot for using a 401k. Now, we have clients that have employees and have 401k plans and are investing in real estate. But that kind of plan, I'd say, is not a no-brainer. When we do those plans, we kind of first do a consulting call so people understand the compliance considerations that come along with having employees in a plan, a full-blown ERISA plan that's investing alternative assets. Because 401k plans are way more complex, because when you think about it, it's the same tax code and labor code that Amazon and Coca-Cola are dealing with. So it has a lot more complexity. If you truly are solo, and that means to say you have no employees in any business that you own, then solo is the way to go. But you want to make sure you are truly solo, because if you have employees in some other business, even your side hustle where you have no employees is not going to be treated as solo by the IRS.
Got it. If you have, let's say you've got a side hustle and you want to create a solo 401k, but you also own another business that has an employer too, you can't create a solo. Is that
that has employees? Or it's a business you own that has employees. Exactly.
Got it. Got it. Very interesting. And so is the solo 401k though, let's say you are a solo entrepreneur, you're doing it because you have a W-2 and a side hustle. Does that have the freedom of a self-directed IRA, similar to like a custodial account, self-directed, where you can invest in real estate, you can invest in other things outside of just the normal mutual funds and stocks?
So 401k differs very much from an IRA, because a 401k does not have to have a financial institution custodian at all. So you get checkbook control without any of the fancy footwork. So we're doing checkbook control, we're inserting an LLC or a trust kind of in conjunction with an IRA custodian. In contrast, a 401k does not need an LLC or additional trust. The 401k trustee can be the business owner.
Got it. Interesting. Interesting. As an entrepreneur, business owner myself, this is all fascinating stuff. So hopefully other guests and other listeners are getting as much value as I am. So we kind of talked about ways to access more capital, right? If you're listening and you're like, hey, I really want to get involved in real estate, but you don't have a ton of cash just sitting in the bank account that you want to, you know, throw into a real estate investment. Obviously, access to old 401ks is a very powerful tool that you can use, right? Obviously, my wife and I've used it. It sounds like you've used it. So let's say you've gone into an investment, and let's talk about, like, I guess let's start with a cost seg, because I feel like this is almost like a stepping stone. You got the investment capital from the IRA accounts, you buy the asset, you do a cost seg, and then you sell it, and then you do a 1031. So let's just kind of follow that logic and kind of walk through this. So you're in an investment. What does a cost seg do, and why would a general partner or even a limited partner be interested in a cost segregation analysis?
Yeah, let's do it, because these things really do work together. Something that I feel like should point out, self-directed retirement accounts are very powerful, but we certainly don't want people getting into them with any misconceptions. So one thing to understand is real estate provides great tax deductions in the form of depreciation tax deductions. And that's what cost seg is about. When you have an investment in your IRA, in the eyes of the IRS, the IRA is its own person. It's its own taxpayer. Now, being that an IRA doesn't generate taxable income, it doesn't generate deductions either. So it's like axiomatic in the tax code that only an activity that can create taxable income can create deductions.
Got it. So if you're invested in an asset with a self-directed IRA and they do a cost seg, that doesn't really benefit you because you're not getting any taxable income.
Exactly.
Okay. So for sake of this example, let's just assume you use cash, right? So you're generating passive income. So let's say you put $100,000 into a $10 million investment, or it doesn't matter the numbers, I guess, but let's talk through cost seg and kind of what that means and how that works.
Yeah. So this is great stuff. Let's talk about depreciation for a moment. Let's talk about why losses are exciting in real estate. Because typically when you report a tax loss on a tax return for a business, it may represent a tax deduction or something that can offset some other income, but economically it's bad news, right? Loss means there's money being lost. The fact that it takes, maybe it's worth something, the fact that it offsets some other income, but overall it's not a good thing. Now in capital intensive businesses, which real estate is, because you're always buying, most of your money is buying assets. The tax code gives you a tax deduction for the assets that you acquired. Now, this is not something that you get to say, hey, I bought a building. The building costs $10 million. You get a $10 million tax deduction in year one. It gets depreciated over time. So typical multifamily asset, right? You're looking at, it's residential real estate. gets depreciated over 27 and a half years. So if the purchase price was 10 million or 100 million, we're going to oversimplify a bit. We're going to leave land out of the picture, land allocation. You're taking that number, you're dividing it by about 27, and you're taking a chunk of that over each year, over 27 years.
So it's a normal depreciation schedule.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Straight line depreciation, 27 and a half years. Now that's a tax deduction. It didn't cost you any money. Mm-hmm. You still own that real estate. You didn't give it away. It didn't get destroyed. Right. And in all likelihood, it's gone up in value. Despite that, you're getting a tax deduction for the cost of that real estate.
Got it.
Now, when you get that tax deduction and that creates a loss, that's a loss that we can all celebrate. Because cash on cash, if we take your depreciation away, you're positive, right? Yeah. It's only this non-cash tax expense that results in you reporting a tax loss. So that's what's really exciting about depreciation. Now, the thing about depreciation is 27 and a half years is a long time. And if we could somehow take a lot of that depreciation up front, right, that could be really, really powerful economically.
Yeah, especially because these syndications are typically 4 to 6 year holds, right? So it's 27 and a half year horizon, like you're not really benefiting from the last 21 years, theoretically.
Yeah, well said. Exactly. Now, here's what happens. Depreciation can do, firstly, if you have net positive income from that real estate deal, depreciation can eliminate that, so you're not paying any taxes.
Right.
But let's take into the next level where you're actually reporting a loss. Right. Now, what can you do with a loss? That will vary. But ideally, what you want to do with a loss is offset other income. So say you've got business or W-2 income. If you can take that loss and net it against that income, that's super powerful. Or if you've got other investments, right, that have just sold, right? Maybe you were in a deal and they just sold. And now all of a sudden you have a large tax bill, or you would have a large tax bill from that sale, from that exit, right? Yeah. So you want to use this loss to offset that income. So cost segregation creates these very, very substantial tax losses. That's the first step of it. The second step is, how will that loss impact a particular investor? And no two investors are alike. So a passive investor in a deal is typically going to get what we call a passive loss.
Okay.
And that will benefit them if they have passive income to offset. If they don't have
from that deal or another investment, it kind of all marries together.
Exactly.
Got it.
Now, if they do not currently have passive income to offset, it goes on their form 8852 and it gets carried forward to a subsequent year to see if they have a passive loss, passive income at any point, and it will net out at that point.
And how far does it carry forward? Like, let's say they made an investment 2023, so they've got passive losses, but they don't make another investment where they generate income until 2025. Is it still there?
Still there. All good.
Got it.
It sits there on the tax return. It gets carried forward and it's waiting, kind of lying in wait, stealthily ready to ambush any passive taxable income.
Got it. That is powerful. Because like you said, like if you, obviously, typically these bigger deals, you're going to get a passive loss your first year. And then because they do like bonus appreciation, I'm sure you'll talk about, but if you start to sell assets, like if you've been investing, then you're going to get income, right? You want to be able to offset that as much as possible so that your tax burden is low as possible.
Yeah, exactly. And let's talk about how this actually works.
Yeah.
You know, what does cost segregation do? So when you buy an asset for a lump sum, you can go ahead and just invest it, depreciate it over 27 and a half years. In reality, though, if we can go out and break that asset into a whole range of different tax asset classes. And real estate is 27 and a half years if it's residential, 39 years if it's commercial. Mm. But there are other assets that are, can be 5, 7, 15, 20, right? That's much shorter. And above and beyond that, there are certain items that are eligible for bonus depreciation, which lets you write off nearly all of the cost of those assets in year one. One way I like to illustrate this, way to think about cost segregation, is kind of like a tax time machine, What it is okay. You kind of go into all the subsequent years and you take a chunk of depreciation in each of those years. And then you come back to the current year and you claim all of that in year one. So what happens with cost segregation is in each subsequent year, your depreciation tax deduction is slightly lower. I just had a client ask about this today. I mean, it's an oral illustration. So we illustrate what you get in year one, and we also illustrate the lower depreciation that you're going to claim in all subsequent years. But the power here is that kind of in year one, you're claiming 27 years all at once. The impact on subsequent years, decreased depreciation, right, in each particular year is nominal, is negligible. But in year one, you're kind of showing this huge tax deduction. And to put it into context, the tax deduction is based on the cost of the asset, not on your equity. This is where it gets really powerful. So say you put your 25% down, and whether you're doing your own deal or it's a syndicated deal, right? And so say that the equity in the deal is $5 million, but it's a $20 million deal.
Yeah.
The depreciation deductions are claimed on the $20 million of purchase, even though you only put in, so that you get the benefit of leverage, not just on your financial returns,
right?
You get the benefit of leverage on your tax returns.
Got it. And even though you're going to have less of a tax loss deduction or appreciation on subsequent years, you're having that massive hit positively, I guess, if you will, on the first year, which will carry forward. And theoretically, if you're doing, let's just say a deal a year, you're getting that, and they do a cost seg, you're getting that benefit each year. So you're kind of stacking up those depreciation losses, if you will.
Yeah. And it's very much and something, and this is also a good segue to 1031 exchange, the true power of a tax deduction. What is this all about? It's very much about time value of money and opportunity cost. So it is true, right, that when you do a cost segregation, we're not creating tax deductions out of thin air. It would be misleading to say that. What we're doing is we're kind of, as I said, we're going into the future. We're collecting those future tax deductions and we're taking them up front. Now, what is the real power of that? So say you would have paid $100,000 in taxes and now you're paying $100,000 less in taxes.
Right.
Now, it's not just the savings of that year. It's also that now you take $100,000, put it into a deal, and you're earning money on that money.
Yep.
And you just got yourself another cost seg.
Right. I'd say you probably just got another deduction. And so you're just carrying that loss, AKA your benefit, forward.
So if what you're getting is the benefit of time value of money, so if your annualized return on a deal is 10%, right? If you rinse and repeat, this is worth a fortune. This is worth millions and millions. Likewise, in a 1031 exchange,
yeah, so let's kind of dig into the 1031 because I've never done one. I'm in a syndication group and typically we only bring in 1031 exchanges that are at a certain value level, right? Because there is complexity to the structure of a syndicated deal if you allow 1031 exchanges. Maybe let's start in general terms. What is a 1031 exchange? And then we can kind of talk about, because I've also heard other people do 1031s in like smaller deals, like single family houses that they've sold and maybe they're passing on or saving like $100,000 versus millions.
Yeah, let's do it. So 1031 exchange allows you to avoid paying the capital gains tax when you sell real estate at a gain. Let's use a single family rental. It's good to illustrate that. And let's do all cash purchase and all cash sale. Again, it simplifies.
Yeah.
So let's say somebody bought a property, they bought a couple of years ago, and they paid $500,000 for it. And now they're selling it for $1 million. Mm. We've had things appreciated very rapidly the last couple of years.
Yeah.
Now, if they sell that, they're going to have a tax bill. And 1031 exchange allows them to sidestep that tax bill. But I would love to dive into it more because to really appreciate the power of 1031, we've got to get a bit into the nitty gritty. So the first thing we got to understand is, hey, what's the value? What we're really got to ask is, what is the value of doing a 1031 exchange? So the first thing is, what would the tax liability be out of 1031 exchange? Occasionally, I turn the tables. I'll ask a question, if I may. What would you say is, what's their taxable gain in this scenario? They bought it a couple of years ago for $500,000, selling it for $1 million. What's the gain?
Half a million.
If only it were the case. What happens is, tax gain, economically, to a certain extent, that would be true. But in the eyes of the tax code, you have to calculate a $1 million minus your adjusted tax basis. So it's not minus what you purchased it for, it's minus your adjusted tax basis, which is minus any depreciation tax deductions you were allowed to take. So if you were, and again, keeping it simple, right, over those, that couple of years that you held the property, you would have been allowed to claim X amount of tax deductions. So your taxable gain is 1 million, right? But you got to take out 500, but you also have to add on any depreciation deductions that were allowed. So the gain is actually going to be higher than that half a million. Now, because many folks kind of don't realize that, and they're like, oh, I'll skip the 1031 exchange, right? What's my gain? All right, I can eat gain a taxes on $500,000. I'll eat the taxes. But it's really could be substantially higher than that. Now, what is the actual tax liability going to be on that? Right? That's going to be capital gains tax plus net investment income tax plus state and local, right? You're in Texas. I'm in New York. So that differs. So in places like New York City, we're privileged to get state and local tax, right? So there's actually three layers of income tax. New Jersey, that's next door, right? They're just state tax, but it's just about as high as New York's, the combination of the two. But so if you're in Texas, you're looking at about a 24% tax rate. And most of the other states, you're looking at something between 30 and 36%, depending on your mix of tax, state and tax, state and local. Now, that tax bill is going to be a hefty tax bill, giving up 25% to 35% of your income, right? But here's where the rubber hits the road. If you do not do the 1031 exchange, not only are you foregoing hundreds of thousands of dollars in cash currently, you're essentially foregoing hundreds of thousands of dollars of equity in your next real estate deal. And for every $100,000 of equity, you could buy $400,000 of real estate, right? So every $100,000 in taxes essentially costs $400,000 in real estate.
Now, that's a good way to look at it.
Even have CPAs that say, I tell my clients, don't do a 1031 exchange. Don't complicate your life. Just skip it. Pay some taxes. But when you view the opportunity cost, that kind of puts it in a whole new light. And if you can think about rinse and repeating that, we're talking about, again, tens of millions of dollars over a lifetime. Not every 1031 exchange is successful, but it's worth initiating that process because it's a nominal cost to pay for a potentially incredibly huge upside. It's like a totally asymmetric risk reward.
Now, the one kind of couple things you've got to consider if you are looking at a 1031 is there is a time limit when you need to invest that capital, right? So if you get, let's just use round numbers, if you get $100,000 that you can invest in a 1031, it's like 45 days you have to identify your next investment. The investment has to be similar but more expensive or something than the deal you just sold. And you've got to close it in another 45 days. I may have those numbers mixed up or off, but you can't just like say, I'll do a 1031 and then kind of start looking for your next deal. You've almost got to have your next one kind of lined up or pretty close to it so you can kind of make sure you check all those time boxes.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is where we have what we call exchanges that are failed. Now, failed exchanges don't cost you any taxes. It just means you don't get the benefit of a 1031 exchange. And we ended up, the IRS gave us guidelines for how to do a 1031 exchange. And those guidelines are a blessing and a curse. Prior to getting these guidelines from the IRS, it was a bit of the Wild West. If you were really aggressive, you could structure exchanges where it took place over years and years and decades. Right? But there was a risk because, all right, if the IRS saw this, what would they say? You got too creative. The IRS lost a very big tax case known as a Starker case. The IRS said, you know what? We're going to give you guys a way to do this. And if you follow these rules, we'll leave you alone. If you go outside those rules, right? It's fair game.
Right.
And so in those rules, they told us you have 180 days to acquire your next property.
And
within 45 days, you have to identify which a certain number of properties that you're considering. And that's where you get 1031 timelines. And yes, you got to work within those timelines.
Yeah. Got it. And so it sounds like 1031 exchanges aren't just for big deals. You could make very smart financial sense to use your example. If you bought a single family house for X amount of dollars and you sold it for a decent increase, it could make sense to do a 1031 in that instance as well, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I'd say in a certain way, it makes more sense in those cases. When you have bigger deals, right? Putting together the next deal is not as easy. It takes a lot more, right? And you have different partners and LPs and GPs that want to go in different directions.
Yeah.
When you bought a single family rental, you're in control. You don't got to deal with any partners. You want to do an exchange, you can do it and you can make it happen on your own.
Got it. Yeah, it makes sense. Because I'm in the syndication world, typically the syndications are much larger and the 1031s are much larger and all that. So this has been super interesting. We've dug really deep into a few different things that are maybe listeners haven't really thought of before or haven't been exposed to before. Like I said, my journey started and before we even learned about this whole self-directed IRA scenario. So I guess if people want to kind of, and you help clients kind of structure or identify what could be a good option for them. So if they're like I was, and they don't have any clue of what this is, they can reach out to you and kind of look you up at Resure Financial and kind of figure out if it makes sense to move one of their old 401ks into a self-directed or however the process works. Is that kind of how you operate now?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a button on the website that says click to schedule a call. A member of the team takes the call. It's a Zoom. They kind of go through a flow chart to help folks figure out where they belong. Because it really is not one size fits all. What we've done is something very, very unique in the industry. So I come at this with a CPA background and I do a lot of consulting for self-directed retirement accounts for people that have their accounts set up elsewhere. As I mentioned, there are about 60 to 70 players in the space, but I personally have kind of have seen it all. So if anybody has worked with any provider, I can see what goes on.
Yeah.
So what we've done is, we've created these accounts. We've realized the majority of investors can fit into one or certainly LPs can fit into one, two very specific, easy to maintain self-directed retirement account structures. And we do those at incredibly low cost. And we're the advisors that folks will speak with, though.
Yeah.
Rather than telling them to give free tax advice, right, to realize the point at which somebody needs professional advice. And they may tell them that, hey, schedule a call with Bernard, which will most likely be a paid consult. But I have folks that I talk to that have broken the rules or not set up the optimal account. So rather than do that, we tell folks, you know, an ounce of prevention is worth more than tons and tons of cure. So that's the way it would work. We've got a button to schedule 1031 calls, cost segregation. For every cost segregation, we provide a free, no charge feasibility analysis to kind of give folks an idea of how's it going to turn out for them? How do we expect this to play out? So yes, there's a button there. And we've also got a space where there are lots of posts where folks can do research. It's searchable.
Okay.
Members.resurefinancial.com. It's got sections dedicated to 1031 exchange, self-directed retirement accounts, and cost segregation. And thankfully, it's searchable. Put something in the search bar. You should get a hit.
Very cool. Well, Bernard, let's transition to the final kind of three questions I ask every guest. This has been a super interesting and deep dive into some kind of technical areas, but you've been able to explain it. So at least I understand it. So that means a lot of other people listening that are way smarter than I am have been able to understand it as well. So kind of the three pack of questions. You are a passive investor. We talked about that kind of off air. So this question is still kind of relevant, but what is one piece of advice that got you started or helped you along your real estate journey? And you can also use it because you started a business. So maybe your entrepreneurial business journey as well. So we'll kind of skirt the rules a little bit on that one.
Yeah. There's a bit of a tug and a pull between analysis and action.
Mm.
And I think, you know, maybe just because my nature, right? Heavy on analysis.
Yeah.
But sometimes you need somebody to push you off the cliff. And so I think that kind of taking action, right? I think that's key, right? Don't be blind, but take action ultimately. That's what I think is key.
Yeah, you definitely get sucked into analysis paralysis because there's a lot of cool, interesting things going on in the real estate world. And it's like, I want to do this, I want to do that. And then you start to dig into it and you just don't do anything. So pick one, take a direction and go from there. So very cool. What's your favorite real estate or business book that you're into right now?
Okay, I have to come up with a new one because for a while I've been saying this. But I would say Nassim Nicholas Taleb's series, Incerto, is something that I love. Business life provides a refreshing perspective and a perspective that is much more aligned with what we live and feel every day, so to speak. Initially, in my financial journey, I was kind of like sold on efficient market theory and all this stuff. And to a certain extent, that stuff is true to some extent or another in the stock market. In real estate and entrepreneurship, it is not true.
A little different. Got it. Fair enough. All right. Well, last question. If you hit your financial freedom number, meaning you can live an amazing life off of just the passive income you're generating from investments, what would you do?
What would I do if I had that financial freedom? How would I spend my time?
Yep.
I would probably still do some of what I do because I really love it and I really love helping people. But I think anybody, something worth mentioning, when you look out for a service provider, whether that be essentially your GP is your service provider, your investment sponsor is a service provider, your 401k self-directed retirement company is a service provider. Everybody interacting with, look for people that want to help people, but of course there's a fee for the service, but they're primarily driven by like, hey, just doing the best they can for everybody they come in contact with. But I certainly would devote more time to family and certain personal development goals that I have. That's where I think would be personal development, family, and continuing to do what I do today.
Very cool. Well, this has been super helpful for me specifically, but also imagine a lot of our guests got a lot of information out of this. You mentioned a website before, but if people do want to reach out because they either are new and they just want to kind of learn more, or they are having, maybe they ran into a scenario and they want to get your help getting out of that scenario, how can people find you, reach out to you? Where's the best way to get you?
Yeah. So I am active on social media, particularly LinkedIn, but reshorefinancial.com. That's R-E-S-U-R-E financial.com. We'll find there 1031 page, call segregation page, and a self-directed IRA 401k page. Somewhere hidden in there is a page for advisory and consulting services, which is typically reserved for people that had an account set up incorrectly. And now they've heard that maybe they need a little
extra
a little mending, exactly. And that's what that page is for. It's not front and center, but if you're looking for it, you'll find it. In addition, we've got members.reshorefinancial.com. It's primarily a space that has a lot of videos, blog posts about all the topics that we discussed.
Very cool. Bernard, man, I really appreciate the time. It's been great connecting with you. Yeah, man, thanks for being on the podcast.
Justin, I love this. I love doing this. And thank you so much for the opportunity.
Awesome. Thank you.
I hope you got value out of this episode of the Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast, your one-stop shop for education on how you can continue to work hard in your career and have different options to invest even harder. If you took anything away from this episode, please like and comment. I read every comment as it helps me serve you better. Make sure to subscribe and hit the notification bell. That way you won't miss out on more valuable content. If you're watching this video, it means that you want to grow your passive real estate portfolio. The easiest way to do that is to join our investor club by heading to greatventurecapital.com/invest. The link is in the show notes. See you on the next episode.